Today is Monday, August 31st, 2020. My name is Noah Schoen, and I'm an interviewer with the OHSS Education Narratives Project. I'm here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with Carol Murray, who is in Hudson, New York, or?
Yes, I'm in Annandale on the Hudson.
Gotcha. In Annandale on the Hudson, New York. This is the second interview that me and Carol have recorded together. And we spoke about a month ago, Carol, and just to kind of open this interview up, I would love to just get up to speed about what has been happening for you in the past month.
Great. Yeah, so that was, I remember we had that interview and I was getting ready to leave. I was traveling, which was significant because of COVID. And I remember the next day I traveled to Las Vegas because my father has been very sick, and I went to help my mom and help my father get on hospice. So I ended up spending about 14 days with my mom and dad, and my father died the day before I left. I had to come back. I had a deadline where I had to get back to New York because of the quarantine and the travel bans. So my father died on Sunday and I came back to New York on Monday. I went into a hotel because I wanted to be super safe about the quarantine rules. And my son was getting ready to go to college and he was really worried about being exposed because he had to get clearance to go to Syracuse University. So I stayed in a hotel by myself for about 4 or 5 days. I did a COVID test and I got the results back. And then I went home and had to complete my quarantine, but I was quickly like needing to work. So I was just Zooming and calling and emailing and doing everything I could. I even had to come to school a few times after hours by myself to get things ready so that we could get our school open because the semester was quickly upon us. It's a very memorable, crazy time, like no other with experiencing the death of my father during COVID and seeing, you know, the hospice workers come to our house with their masks and their shields and all their equipment and all their gear to protect them from sick people who could possibly have COVID, seeing, you know, the way that they cared for my father, the way that I was really called to care for him as well, and sort of the whole experience of being with a loved one through COVID and through death, and not being able to have funerals and all that stuff. It's been a very, you know, very memorable, remarkable time in history. Yeah. So I've been in the midst of reopening the school this week.
Sorry to hear the passing of your father.
Thank you. Thank you.
As I hear you use the word care to talk mm-hmm. about these last weeks with your parents, I'm just thinking back to our first interview where care was such a big theme, and curious if you've had any reflections on care in this time.
I have had a lot of reflections on care. I think one of the biggest things for me with my father was, you know, I wanted to care for him well, and I wanted to sort of be, you know, I think when we have a birth or a death or any significant event like this where we really are called into a caring role that is more heightened than other normal daily life situations, I was thinking a lot about how we have these images or these expectations about what it should be like. And so I thought a lot about that when I was caring for my father. My mom and I both felt really clumsy. My father's a very big man, and we had to do a lot of lifting, positioning. He was losing mobility. We had to feed him. We had to dress him. And we just kept feeling like we don't know what we're doing, and we felt clumsy, and I just kept thinking about like this relationship between a vulnerable person who needs these very physical tasks and someone who is in the position of caring, sort of the responsibility. And I just kept thinking about how care is not perfect. Care is not perfect. And people would say things like, oh, it's such a wonderful, it's such a privilege to be with someone who's dying. And that when the hospice people came, you know, in the situation, people want to talk about when you're going through something hard, people want to recall their experiences. And people would say things to me like, oh, you know, hospice is so wonderful. When they came, that was such a beautiful closure. And my father told these stories. And, you know, for my mom and I, caring for my dad wasn't very beautiful. And it was really scary. And we were just, we barely got hospice set up in time, and then he died. And there were definitely some very profound moments. But I guess I just thought about a lot about that, how care is strong. Care is not soft. Care requires a lot of us, and care is not perfect. Those were the lessons I kept thinking about through that experience. I think even for myself, I had an expectation when I started writing and thinking about care and analyzing care. That it would be more lovely, the care would be more lovely. And it is, but it's all things. It's hard. It requires a great deal of strength. And then coming back to work, that helped, that thinking about that helped me a lot, thinking about sort of how care is not perfect. I had to tell myself that a lot to kind of forgive myself or to make space to be able to see what was really happening and not feel guilty or feel disappointed, you know, just to be able to be present and to see what was in front of me when I was caring for my dad. I felt like I had to remind myself that it was hard and that it was not perfect, but it was many times tender and moving and full of little graces. And when I came back to work, I thought I had my whole plan. I had my COVID plan. I'd been working on it all summer. I had all the details ironed out. And it was really hard last week. It was really hard, harder than I expected it would be. And I think the hard part, we had the kids come back just for half days so that we could have some time, more time with the adults, with the teachers to talk through our needs and talk through the details about the day, the cleaning, the sanitation, the masks, all the various things that we do differently now. Once again, it was really hard. It wasn't always lovely. It wasn't always lovely. There was a lot of joy. The kids were amazing. The playground was beautiful. We were outside. We pretty much are exclusively outside. We've made a commitment to care for children outside as much as we possibly can. And we have tents set up on the playground. The kids all have rain gear. We have outdoor washing, hand washing stations. So we've done a lot of work to change the environment and to be open air as much as we can. And it's, and the kids are just amazing. They're so happy to be back together. But the adults, the teachers were having a hard time. It was more stressful on the teachers than I had anticipated. And there were differences. There were some people who were sort of rolling up their sleeves and saying, you know, here we are, let's get back together. How can I help? And there are other people who were very anxious and hesitant and uncomfortable in the work environment, in the care environment. I had a teacher quit. So that was hard. That was really hard.
I do want to jump into more about the plan and some of the details around that, but I do want to just go back for a moment before school started. Could you share a little bit about your state of mind and the things that you were thinking about, particularly as a school leader?
Sure. I was just feeling really consumed with details, with COVID details. I had to have my plan approved by the various authorities here at the campus. And they were changing a few things about my plan right before we opened. They didn't like my language in certain aspects of the plan where I was describing care. I was describing what a day would look like for a child and a teacher. And I said, although we will practice social distancing by spacing children apart when they eat or when they sleep, by having smaller groups of children working together, you know, that we will still be in pretty close contact with one another because these are young children. And I put some language in there about if a child needs a hug, a teacher will still hug them. If a child needs a hand to hold, if a child needs, you know, help wiping their nose or going to the bathroom, you know, these are things that we do. And that it was funny to me, the administration wanted to take that out. And I said, well, why are you taking that out? And they, I guess it had something to do with liability. They were like, well, that's your profession. You can do what you need to do. You just don't need to put this so explicitly in the plan. And I said, well, the reason I put it in the plan is because I want the parents to understand what the day looks like. And I want the teachers to understand what the day looks like. And that I'm doing everything I can to make this environment safer for opening during a pandemic. But I'm not running a program where children are behind plexiglass or where we are not touching children or working closely with children. So there is a risk. There's a risk for the children and there's a risk for the teachers. We're definitely gonna be wearing masks. The teachers are all wearing masks all the time. Washing hands and, you know, all the various sanitation procedures. But I want there to be an honest, clear understanding that social distancing isn't really possible with these young children. But they did go ahead and took most of my wording out on those things. And then they asked me to also have the children wear masks. And I said, I was willing to take a learning approach that we're in the country. We have a big play yard. We have this opportunity to be outside together. And I really want children to have a mask break when they're outside. I really feel that the transmission rate is very low outside. And I don't know that I believe wearing a mask outside has enough benefit for the very young child. It will, the teachers will definitely wear them, but the child is going to have to take off the mask to have snack. take off the mask to have lunch, take off the mask to have rest time. And we're doing this robust kind of play. We're in the sand, we're in the water, we're getting messy, we're riding bikes, we are swinging. I didn't really feel comfortable having children wear a mask all day. So that was a debate going on about that with me and the administration. And it was just sort of hard to be in that position because I didn't like being in a position where I was being made to feel that I wasn't doing everything I could to keep children safe, you know, because I felt there were benefits. This whole sort of, I guess, risk analysis, you know, the benefits of being outside and not having a mask on your face for a young child and having time during the day when they are playing with other kids in the open air seems to be very important right now. And New York State has said that, of course, children that are going out into public should be wearing a mask. If you're going to the grocery store, if you're going to visit your grandmother, going to church, whatever, you should be wearing a mask. Even, you know, the threes and fours and fives should all be wearing a mask. With public transportation, wearing a mask. I agree with all that. But they also say that the playground attached to the licensed childcare center is not considered a public space. So there was no mandate or law telling me that they had to wear a mask all the time. And the World Health Organization just came out with a whole statement in August about children under five not wearing masks. But, you know, it was just one of those discussions that was really uncomfortable. But we came to the spot where we just said, we're going to take a learning approach. And if we need to scaffold it, so we said, if the children go in the building, they will wear a mask. But as long as we're outside, they know they can take a mask break. And we had little hooks hung right on the playground where they could hang up their mask. And then we just, like, as the week evolved, you know, we said, well, the teacher, there's 10 kids here today, and the teacher wants to get them all together under the tree to sing a song. Maybe we should wear a mask because singing is one of those activities that is known for transmission. And so maybe this is a good opportunity to talk about, well, we're all getting together. We're not spread around the playground. We're all getting together. So let's get our mask. It seemed to work fine. Everyone went over to the little hook, got their mask. We worked on sort of instruction about how to get masks on, and kids did great with it. And then there were other times, like with swinging on the tire swing, you know, we'd say, well, those three kids' faces are like really close to each other when they're spinning on the tire swing and they're shrieking with delight. So that we started saying, well, maybe one kid at a time on the tire swing. And then we said, well, if you really want to spin with two kids, maybe that's one of those situations where you need a mask. And the kids seem to be so adaptable and agreeable and so comfortable with that because they have been seeing this whole evolution of mask wearing over the spring and summer. So I feel like we came to a good spot where we were saying these are times when it seems good to teach kids to wear masks. And we still have this freedom outside. And I tried to explain to BART administration, if you want me to say the kids are going to wear masks all the time, I'll say that. But, you know, if it's a rainy day and everyone has a wet mask on their face because we're playing out in the rain, that's not really going to work, you know. There's just going to be times when you're caring for young children, the masks are going to have to come off. And I just want you to have this understanding that these children are in our care for 40 hours a week. That's a big ask for them to have a mask on for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. In a caring environment that is meant to be, you know, more home-like for a young child. So I think that was probably the biggest point, that whole kid in the mask thing. And I'm not saying kids shouldn't wear a mask. I just wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to have a scaffold approach since our numbers are so low in Dutchess County right now, since we have this beautiful outside classroom, since we can be outside all day and the parents are all on board about playing outside in every season, in all weathers, and they're sending rain suits. I just felt like we had an opportunity to give children some freedom with the play that didn't include having a mask on.
What have you been noticing about the children? How are they doing?
They're great. They're great. Like I said, they're so adaptable. They, you know, I mean, some of the children are not so great about wearing the mask. It'll fall down below their nose. It'll get messy. It needs some adjustment. But for the most part, the parents have done a great job getting these really comfortable, soft masks. And the kids have gotten great about putting them on and understanding. And I mean, I think maybe a few months ago, we would have had a lot more conversations and a lot more instructional time around that. But they talk about, you know, the virus and the coronavirus, and they remind each other about, you know, being too close. They're just ready to play. The kids have come back. Some of the parents were expressing that the children had a lot of anxiety, were hiding and clinging to their legs and feeling shy. And this was like a really big deal to get back in a social situation. But they really have jumped right back into it. They just have, yeah, they're so, so ready to play and to be together, and so full of joy. It's been great. I don't see them being like, I don't see any sort of regression. Like, you know, we have the 4-year-olds, you know, it's not like they're acting like they forgot how to share, or they're grabbing things from one another, or they're having conflicts. The opposite seems true. So far, we've only been together for 5 days now, but the opposite seems true, that they are just really, really happy to have peers.
What about parents? What has your communications been with them like, and how do they seem?
Yeah, that's been interesting. I mean, I have like a lot of different parent contingents I've been communicating with. I mean, the one parent group, which they are the parents of the children who are enrolled in our program. We've been sending them like email updates as we have developed the handbook and the reopening plan, as we've been saying, these are the things you need to send to school. This is how we're going to do drop off. This is how we're going to do pickup. These are the changes. So they've been really involved in helping develop the plan and approve the plan. Of course, we're using the Office of Children and Family Guidelines and the CDC guidelines and all the health consultation we have here on campus. But we've also included them in some areas where we've had choices and how do you feel about this and that. So we have like a little parent board that will give us advice. And then we have the large parent body that has been great. So just, we've done Zooms, we've done explanations over Zooms and emails. And you hear the dog barking? Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want me to close the window?
Do you think that it's passing on?
I think so. I think it all, yeah. Yeah, so the parents of this group have been just wonderful, and they've been very connected, and they've been super appreciative of everything that we have done, and every day have said, you know, this is amazing, this is wonderful, so excited to be back. They've all expressed how hard it has been this summer not to have any support, spring and summer, and how long that they've been in isolation, and they've just been very grateful. And then I have another group of parents that are more like parents that email me and call me. A lot of people calling me because I'm a supervisor, they're calling me to ask for references because so many people are hiring teachers and college students to come into their homes, to do care pods, to help their children with homework once the children get their online sort of protocol, and parents are still trying to work and the schools aren't open. So there's been this huge search for people. So that's been interesting. Emails, advertisements, phone calls, reference checks, like this whole community kind of outreach. How can we find people to care for our kids? And then there's another group of parents, which are school age kids, because I'm also starting an outdoor program for children kindergarten through age 5 here on campus. Because the schools aren't opening, we're doing something we're calling an open air adventure club, which is going to be an exclusively outdoor program. So I've had a lot of contact with different parents needing different things. And I feel like there was like a pause, like back in July, where I felt like, you know, people are realizing what's really important, you know, that people are hopefully coming to see that caring for children isn't something that just anybody can do. They're seeing how hard it is to have that demand placed on them. And I hope they're getting a better feeling for I don't know, I guess just that massive infrastructure of caregivers that sort of support society, that because no one was doing a lot of people were open through COVID, but a lot of people weren't. So parents were having to have so much extra responsibilities. But then I just saw a big switch flip in August. And I think it was like almost like that appreciation got thrown out the window and people were panicking because they realized that schools were not going to open and they realized that they weren't going to get their life back as they had hoped and the coronavirus wasn't going away. And I just felt really concerned about the kind of phone calls and emails I was getting and asking people to describe what they needed and what they were looking for. And I felt like there was just a really big expectation being placed on those of us who care for children. In terms of how much money people were willing to pay, and in combination with, I started collecting some of the ads and things that were rolling around on the emails. And you know, it's just like these young professional couples describing themselves and describing their beautiful child, and then saying like, oh, and we're going to have, you know, 3 other fourth graders in our home because we're going to help the neighbors. And we're looking for someone who is creative, and it would be great if you spoke a foreign language, and it'd be great if you had a degree, or maybe you're a grad student working, or maybe you're interested in psychology or child development or education. That would be great. And, you know, and it would be great if you respected our family life. and we have a dog, and in return, we will give you a bedroom in our house, things like that. Like, we're looking for someone to move in with us basically and take care of our kid and her friends and teach them. And while they're doing their online fourth grade, what stuff like that. I was like, who? And I don't know, it just seemed like this, I started thinking a lot about care as a sort of servitude, and people's sort of ownership of others. And some of the reference calls I was getting, people were saying, we don't want a babysitter. You know, we want someone who can teach. Our kids have to get online and they have to learn. So we need someone who can supervise this and this and this. And do you think this person is qualified? And it just kind of irritated me when people would ask me that. And so I would have to say back to them, well, I'd like you to think about what you're saying. You know, you're asking they're asking for a reference for this college student who just graduated from college. And I said, she's a wonderful person. She's super with kids. But if you're telling her you don't want a caregiver, but you do want a teacher, what message are you giving her for your kindergartner? I mean, to me, I think the most important thing she should be doing is connecting with you. And she's in your home. So are you going to want her to make lunch with your kid? Yes. You know, so you're going to want her to, you know, have some playtime with your kid in the backyard. Yes, I'm going to want that too. And I just said, well, I just think that this is a time in history when we have to start thinking that there is not a big separation between care and education. And if we're telling these people that we're asking these people to come into our homes, that's a pretty special opportunity. That's very intimate. So the way we form relationships with one another is through care and conversation. And those skills need to come first. I don't think you should make that subordinate to getting your kid online and making sure they do their kindergarten homework or whatever. I couldn't hold back from having those conversations with people because I just heard so many qualifications and expectations that seemed, it just seemed like it was that. I know well-meaning people, very well-meaning people, but it just seemed like we were throwing out our appreciation for the time we're living in and for things that we're asking of one another right now, and panicking, you know, and just having these talks with parents. Kids aren't behind. Kindergartners do not need to be online. They will learn everything they need to know by being in a good relationship with an adult who cares about them, who could read them a good story, who could take a walk with them, who could make a peanut butter sandwich with them. These things are really more essential than whatever crazy Google Classroom setup that's going to be offered. So I've seen a lot of gratitude from parents, but I've also seen a lot of crazy expectations. And that's the other thing I've thought a lot about is boundaries. The care must have boundaries to be healthy. and people put care back on you. They say, well, you're such a caring person. You know, like I had a teacher who quit and she said to me, she was unhappy with some things about the plan. She really did not want to go in the building ever. She was very strict about the 6-foot distancing. And I said, you know, when I have a mask on and you have a mask on and we're standing outside, I'm going to need to come closer to you to give you this message. And she wasn't comfortable with that. And she was just really fearful, and I respect that. There was a lot of anxiety and fear, and I understand everyone has different comfort levels. I'm not trying to shame anyone for feeling afraid. We're in a pandemic, but she wanted more accommodations than I could offer in order to do this work that were really interfering. And one of the things she said to me was, you know, I don't feel cared for by you. And I just said, well, this is one of those experiences where you haven't ever felt a boundary from me. I've never had to say no to you. And right now I have to say no. I have to say no, and I have to have a boundary because I do care. I care about this school, and I have to make decisions that are going to be in the best interest of running this program. So we're up against a boundary right now. And you have a responsibility to make a decision about whether or not you can work in this environment. So yeah, so boundaries, but it is funny when people put that back on you, like, you're supposed to be so caring. And so how could you, you know, how could you say no? Yeah. So I guess there are a lot of things like sort of the flip side of, I don't know if it's the flip side, but I guess there's just a lot of these harder lessons that I feel like I've learned about the boundaries and about the imperfections and the messiness of care. We want to idealize it. We want to think it's soft and sweet and lovely. But if you go back to the original, like the origin of care, you know, coming into the world, being birthed is not really easy. It's hard. So there's pain. I mean, life has a certain amount of pain. And yeah, I feel that it's so joyful to be with the kids, but it isn't easy. It isn't easy for anyone who's leading a program right now. I've encountered things I've never encountered. Yeah, and something like that. Last week was really hard, losing a really good teacher.
What do you think it means to accept that? Actually, before I ask a question, were you going to say something else?
Mm-mm. No.
Just wondering, what is the significance of accepting that care is imperfect? What does it mean for us?
I think it's this moment between two people that is always going to be original. It's a true dialogue. If you think about care in that way, that it's always going to be interpretive. It's always going to be new and different and original because it's human work. So I think, just like a conversation, you know, if it's a true conversation, you can't impose your direction on the other. You have to receive. So if we really analyze the care relationship and think about sort of the ethics of care, like, then we have to respect that dialogue, that human encounter, which is messy, unpredictable, joyful, surprising, original, all those things. It's an unknown frontier. We don't know. We can't assume that we know what is best for someone else. So I think that, I guess that is, accepting that imperfection helps me be open to the authenticity of the relationship. It also helps me try not to be such a controlling person. I mean, I think the care dynamic often involves a vulnerable. It doesn't always, like in the situation with me and this teacher, I would say she was the vulnerable because I have more power. I'm her boss. I'm the one that's deciding what the rules are. And she even said to me, we always had a team approach, you know? And I said, yeah, you're right. We always had a team approach, but right now I'm making this decision. You know, I listened to everything you said, but now this is my decision. This is the way it is. And I have to be the one responsible for this. So there's that weird dynamic, like, yeah, we respect each other as equals, but there is usually some weird power. I don't know. It's not weird. I don't know why I said weird, but it's just, someone is more vulnerable than the other. You know, it's obvious in a situation where there's a child, an adult who is more vulnerable. It's less obvious between a married couple or two colleagues. But I think you can still apply some of that ethics of care in terms of dialogue and listening and respecting and responding to the other. And so that imperfection for me, when I'm in the less vulnerable role, when I'm caring for my father or I'm caring for the children or caring for teachers, for me to say it's imperfect helps me because sometimes I think we overcare. We're not always able to find a healthy way to care for other people. So we care in a way that imposes our will on others or denies our own needs. I don't know if that makes sense, but there's always this weird shifting where you're trying to evaluate how to meet the other. So when I'm in a role of leadership or if I'm it feels like a really big responsibility. It feels like a really big responsibility and it's imperfect. It's imperfect. But I think evaluating or analyzing sort of our decisions and our organizations with that care ethic helps us create more healthy organizations and relationships. It's just not easy.
What has it been like for teachers? You've talked about this one teacher, but I'm wondering if you have any other reflections on how your teachers are doing in this moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's this weird feeling of clumsiness for all of us. And one thing that the one teacher who quit kept repeatedly getting upset about last week was that it was so hot and we were working outside and we were all wearing masks and other teachers would lift up their mask to take drinks. And so there was sort of etiquette we had to work out. So the one teacher felt very offended that anyone would take their mask off when she was near them. And then the other teacher, oh, sorry, I was, you know, I guess I wasn't taking it seriously enough or I didn't realize that we just hadn't worked out those kind of etiquette things. So there's a clumsiness that comes with like all the sanitation, hand washing, avoiding crowds, wearing a mask. Our work is very physical. It's very embodied. we are in close contact with children and one another. So there was a lot of clumsiness, definitely. That was surprising to me how clumsy we all felt. And it also was kind of, it was also the way I felt with my dad. It was like, and then, and I just thought a lot about like, wow, care is very bodily. It's this whole physical embodied work. So we had to work out all that stuff. Like, okay, where can we take a mask break? Where can we, how do we feel about eating and drinking? Where do we need to go to do those things? Where do we keep our water bottles? Where do we, how do we pass one another? You know, like I said, the one teacher did not feel comfortable walking through the hall. There's like one narrow hallway. She just did not want to walk past others in the hallway. I said, I think it's okay because we're all wearing masks. She said, no, she wanted 6 foot distance and a mask. It just was getting really hard. And I don't want to be casual about it. I want us to do this well. I don't want to say it's not important. I appreciate that part of that teacher who's so detail oriented. We want to figure out how to do this well. And I think it has to be scaffolded. It just wasn't working out to try to keep 6 foot distance while doing this kind of work. So yeah, the other teachers, but you know, so many people have just come with like their sleeves rolled up and said, let's figure this out. Let's do this. I want to get back to work. I want to be with kids. I want to be with families. I'm here to help. I realize there are risks and I want to get back to work. I really want to be doing this. So it's been really heartwarming to see the level of 110% that so many people have given to get us reopened again. There aren't any, it's not, you think that, you know, when you put that plan together, that it feels quite rigid, but when you start living it, and that was another discussion between the teacher who was unhappy, it really isn't that rigid. It can't be that rigid because there just always seems to be, we always seem to be coming up against an exception. So we need that sort of template to help us figure out how to do things in this new way. But we always have to be open to change and growth and moving in one way, one direction or the other. In some ways, we've gotten a little bit more conservative, I think, with, you know, figuring out how to take a drink of water and how to have kids wear masks more than I actually thought they would. And the kids are really pretty good about it. In other ways, we've gotten a little more lenient. I think because we're outside so much, you know, so I just imagined us marching these kids out to the cars, you know, one by one at the end of the day and no one having contact, but you know, the parents have their masks on, the parents are getting out of their cars and having chats with us. And so in those ways, we're still connected in a way that feels good and feels very human. And it doesn't feel, you know, like we put the kids in plexiglass boxes or anything like that. It feels pretty close to normal sometimes.
I'm remembering in our last interview, this concept of faith came up, relationship to care. I'm wondering if that has any resonance with how this moment of reopening has been.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. I mean, I guess for me, I think faith, like I said, I think I don't remember exactly what I said before, but just faith in human potential, faith in sort of human development, it seems that definitely carries us. I mean, there was a point in the week last week where the teacher said, you know, we'd have little debriefings and little meetings every day, and okay, let's try this and let's try that, and let's put the hand sanitizer by this door, but we have a sink by that door, and all the details. And they just at one point said, can we stop talking about COVID? You know, can we stop talking about COVID and just talk about the kids, you know, the personalities and the things that they've said? And so I think that study, that fascination in human life and human development and our connection. And I also think of that in conjunction with being outside with kids, being in nature with kids, that all those things give us faith. You know, we found two caterpillars today. We found a salamander. You know, those were definitely big moments today for the kids. So there's a feeling of life just carrying us, along. There's a feeling of not needing to contrive or plan in ways that we did before. Being less concerned about a lesson plan and more concerned sort of about what's around us. We're looking at the weather a lot. We're trying to use natural materials instead of anything that we have to wash. We're feeling quite campy, you know, setting up our tents and our hand washing stations and our little outdoor classrooms. But it's not coming from a like lesson plan, what checking off a developmental list or academic goals. It's more coming about from like, how can we be together outside and have a good time and really experience joy. So yeah, I think those things that are essential are, we have faith in those things. They carry us.
There's something, oh, go ahead.
Oh no, I just had a weird thought where I just kind of like with, because I had been thinking and writing about care, you know, I kind of like had like this feeling like, I don't know, like to me, when you study something, it gets a little bit more mysterious the more you learn about it. And I just sort of had this feeling like I was starting to see the shape of care, and I was almost like having a conversation like, you know, I know that care has been misunderstood and misinterpreted and underappreciated, and you know, I will study you, I will talk about you, I will try to figure you out, but I need you to kind of teach me, like I need you to, I was talking to care, like I need care to I'll care for care, I need care to care for me, because I kept running against these feelings of imperfection and feeling like, who am I to talk about this? I don't do this well all the time, and I don't sometimes care for myself well. I don't always care for other people well. It's just that, again, that whole thing of imperfection, like this is a fascinating topic. I don't know. So I'm not sure what I'm saying, but I just feel like those hard lessons were sort of came to me after I surrendered to that idea that I knew the direction I was going in when I was talking and writing about care, the harder lessons about the imperfection and the boundaries and the abuses of care. Yeah, I always knew it was underappreciated, but just for me to figure out ways to do it, I don't know, just it, yeah, I'm not sure that made any sense. It just was a one of those little sparks. So I'll have to think that one through.
It sounds like you're just seeing insights are becoming clear that you've been wrestling with for a long time.
Yeah, that's a good way to see it. Wrestling, and I'm still wrestling, yes. Yes.
Anything else you'd like to say about that wrestling?
I guess I have some thoughts from the it felt pretty traumatic losing that teacher, and she said that I was minimizing the seriousness of the pandemic. She felt that I was minimizing the seriousness of the pandemic, and I think, and that's just that's an interesting perspective. I feel the heaviness, you know. There's a weird thing as a leader where you need to project, we can do this, project a positive attitude, we can do this, we're going to do this the best we can, we're going to care for one another, I've got your back, what do you need, come to me, let's talk about it, let's do this. So there's a weird sort of positive attitude that you need to project as a leader. And I feel that. I feel I want to get to work. We can do this. But there is that heaviness inside, the seriousness of the pandemic and sort of the grief that you feel at times. It's just very ironic that she would say that, because I feel such grief at having lost her.
It's a challenging time to be a leader.
It is. And I have so many resources. I don't know how some people are doing it. And the biggest resource to me is the being outside. It's just so beautiful here.
Yeah. Throughout this interview, you've touched on these glimmers. I'm thinking of those caterpillars and.
Oh, yeah.
I'm wondering about the opportunities. Obviously, there are challenges in this moment. What are some of the opportunities you're seeing? And do you hope that maybe anything that you're learning now sticks?
Yes, I do. I do. I feel, you know, being a relatively small school and being in the country and having a beautiful landscape, I have so much freedom. I have so much freedom compared to someone who's leading a large public school. And I feel in my own neighborhood, where my children went to school, we had a small little neighborhood school. And in the last 10 years in my district, all the schools have, a lot of the neighborhood schools have closed and they've moved to this consolidated model. And I wonder now, like, you know, how would school look different if it wasn't consolidated, you know, if we didn't have these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids to get on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of buses. And there's just something about scale that seems really important to me. You know, you're talking about young children, talking about 3 and 4 and 5 year olds. So how many, what's a healthy scale? What's the size of a school? And I think that's the same thing for elementary age and high school, middle school. Like what is the value of a smaller scale? And then there's just so many issues about fairness and what neighborhoods look like, and, you know, the whole public school dilemma, because it needs to be less polarized than it is. It's very complicated, but I think I hope there are opportunities to think about the size and the scale of the schools, and why there aren't more programs moving outside. Why there aren't more initiatives to reorient our goals, more conversations about the purpose of education. And that's sort of where I felt we were going in July. And I felt the teachers would open up this school year, the public school teachers, with more permission to connect with their kindergartners and first graders and be like, what is the purpose of education? You know, really, really, what is it? And how can we, like, have smaller conversations with kids? How can we tell their stories? How can we have them bring in, you know, their collections of pine cones and feathers and caterpillars and get them in their backyards, like these things that we value? How can we do this with families in new ways over Zoom or whatever we have to do, you know? And unfortunately, I hope that there's a few people figuring that out, but I mean, what I see mostly is in some cases a bigger divide, a bigger gulf between these sort of academic goals and, oh, these kids, you know, I am a kindergarten teacher, so I'm going to teach you these things to prove that I am a teacher, to make sure everyone knows that I am teaching. I have this, I don't know, I just see that we're off base a lot, but I think there's been some really great opportunities, and there must be some people taking advantage of those opportunities. And there must be some leaders giving teachers permission to go in those directions.
We're coming towards the end of the interview, but I do want to just ask one thing on what you just said, which is that I remember earlier in the interview you said, it's better for a kindergartner to have a caring adult right now than to be, you know, enmeshed in a whole curriculum. And could you say why that is?
Well, it does come back to faith. I have faith that children will learn what they need to learn, and that the lessons that they need to learn will be true lessons, will be meaningful, intrinsic lessons, if they are done in context of something they care about and with someone that cares about them. I think that random list of things that kindergartners need to know this year can be memorized, but they aren't going to have much meaning and they will quickly be forgotten. And then they'll be memorized again when they're in first grade. So there are some things that will teach children that they have agency and internal locus of control to be thinkers and inventors and creators, you know, sort of get the foundation of critical thinking. We always say, you know, we want kids to be critical thinkers, but then we have these crazy arbitrary goals that don't really involve thinking. So I think kids will think deeply about things and will remember things when they are engaged with an adult who cares about them in a way that allows them to follow their interest, allows them to express their ideas, allows them to be themselves and to ask questions. So that kind of, again, that kind of dialogue that I think is the cornerstone of learning, the cornerstone of education. I think those will be the essential and the lasting lessons for children.
So as we close this interview, is there anything else that you'd like to put on the record, even if it's just for you to remember for yourself?
I don't think so. I mean, yeah, thank you. Thank you for taking me on a good, good little journey again.
Thank you very much.